I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
Writer, bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Linda Lagarde Grover, who is a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth and a member of the Boy Fort Band of Ojibwe. She is the award-winning author of several books, including The Road Back to Sweetgrass, Onagamasing, Seasons of an Ojibwe Year, and In the Night of Memory, all from the University of Minnesota Press. Welcome, Linda.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're so happy to talk to you. We loved your book. Cannot wait to dig in. What would you like to read to us?
I'm going to read a little section from a bit of fiction about the harbor in Duluth, Minnesota.
Yay.
Wonderful.
So this is a piece of a fiction work. Back of Maggie's house, Mickey stood at the shoreline and stepped onto snow-covered ice, his feet warm in Mr. Lukaszewski's boots. Like summer, he thought, wiggling his toes. Late summer, when we had to leave Maggie's and walk to the train to go to boarding school. Mickey walked lightly on warm concrete, a city sidewalk, his paws tapping a silent rhythm that left no prints. Behind walked his cousins, Gurley, Bud, George, and Vernon, resigned to grief yet hopeful, two carrying a lunch for the journey and extra clothing, one holding the hand of a small boy whose round face was shiny and stretched with crying, the sun in captivity. Wee-wee, Ma doesn't want us to miss the train. Bud hoisted the smallest boy up onto his back. They quickened their steps and Mickey became the wolf, leading the pack to the depot. Through his thin-soled boarding school shoes, his paws felt the hardness of hard concrete toward the train depot, the silent pattern and unrelenting and unforgiving song repeating itself in his head and heart, one day, one day, one day. In the spring, they would retrace the steps, but in reverse, their time at boarding school breaking season to season, life to life. Maggie's children and Mayingan created as everything else was to draw breath and appear to fulfill a purpose to leave. And of their time at Herod, surely their purpose there would be to witness, to remember. Now Mickey's feet, warm as summer in Mr. Lukaszewski's boots, stepped onto the frozen bay. They would take a shortcut to the depot, he thought, and not miss the train. And so that February evening then, the wolf, who was also both Waboose and Mickey, loped across the ice-crusted frozen bay, his paws tapping a silent rhythm so light that they left no prints. As he ran, a cloud drifted from the face of the moon that, rising eerily exposed shadowed drifts and peaks of snow, then an expanse of whiteness, and beyond that, the lights of the houses. He saw the way so clearly, the frozen white terrain reflecting moonlight past the blackness of night sky to the stars that grew to glittering flowers that bent in their heaviness toward the earth. In those contrasts of light and dark, Maggie's shingle-sided house was the color of the sky, the light in her kitchen window, a yellow, small and weak in the shadows of the grain elevators that had become columns that changed from white to invisible columns and back again as clouds drifted across the moon. So too, Mayingan's coat changed its hue back and forth, as he ran past elevators, A, B, C, D, along the shoreline, in and out of shadows, the color of lost lake on a summer night, in and out of light of the white of snow, ice, and stars. He ran, thinking of Maggie's house and of Maggie, Lewis, Helen, and Beek inside. The kitchen light would go out, and they would sleep in the sweetness of each other's presence in the little shingle-sided house. He ran, camouflaged by his coat that changed colors under the shifting light of moon, star snows. He ran through night air that cooled and soothed his chest and lungs so that his cough became a memory that could possibly never return. and halfway through across the bay, he thought about what a pleasure it would be to smoke a cigarette in the midst of all that beauty of light and shadow, stars and moonlight, snow and ice, and the twinkling lights of downtown. To smoke a cigarette without wheezing and coughing and spitting. And so he paused to light a match, inhaled to suck the flame into the end of the cigarette, and felt the heaviness of smoldering tobacco sink down into his lungs where it entered his bloodstream that lit as brightly as the surrounding bay. Sagaswa, he said lovingly to the little fire at the end of the cigarette. Beneath Mayingan's feet, beneath the ice where he stood, Mishibijig, the lake spirits, turned their faces toward the glow above and the outline of Mr. Lukashevsky's pair of winter boots. In their silent underwater way of speaking, they recounted to each other the old stories of conflict and revenge, of Nanabuju and his younger twin, Mayingan, of the sacred promise made to the memory of the Ancient One, leader in generations that ruled the lake long before the memory of mortals. His death would be avenged and avenged again. The cold hearts of the Oshki Mishibijig heated and the surface of the frozen lake softened. Wait, the oldest and most experienced said to his underwater voice, as red winter suns throbbed beneath the large ice-gray bodies, and they maintained their patience as the cigarette burned its way down, as the glow of orange dimmed and died. Bees and done, commanded the oldest. They listened as Mayingan coughed deeply and sighed, and then the soles of Mr. Lukashevsky's winter boots began to move, the steps increasing in speed as Mayingan resumed his lope, now heavier and tiring, toward the shore. He grew cold and ran. He ran, boots now feeling like the concrete of winter. Ahead of the lights of the houses near the shore seemed to grow no closer, but soon he would see them. Or should he turn around and go back to Maggie's? Would they hear the heaviness of his breathing that was now becoming a wheeze, a whistle? And would they look out the kitchen window, unable to see him but waiting? Home, he thought, home. Mayingan's lope grew uneven and ragged, the boots sinking through the crust of snow, blemished its shining expanse of whiteness with prints that ringed his legs, just the tops of the boots, and chafed his ankles. Puffing white puffs of breath, he turned and saw, he thought, Maggie's house just up again. Kitchen window again lit, a brighter yellow now, the moon lighting the railroad tracks along the shore to the color of the stars. I'll be there soon, Mayingan said to himself. To settle his nerves, he stopped to roll another cigarette. Almost there, he thought as he struck the match. And the lake spirits, who had followed the outline of Lewis's boots, broke the surface to once again seal the doom of Mayingan, the little brother of Nanabuju. The story was true then, and it was true when Mickey, who bore the spirit of Rabbit and Wolf, repeated the encounter. That is how it was then and how it is today.
I'm so glad you read that part. It's beautiful. One of the most beautiful parts of the book. Yeah. Alex texted me this as you were reading, and it's so true. You are such a wonderful reader.
Oh, thanks very much. That story is sort of an interweaving of a very old Ojibwe story and a sort of fictionalized version of an experience in my family and some of the people that my grandfather knew. And of course, I live, near Lake Superior here, and my family and the Ojibwe people here have a long history of living lives against the backdrop of that beauty and all the formidable dangers of the beings that live in the lake.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had never considered the way that you talk about it in the book, and it's part of the Ojibwe stories, is that there's a whole civilization, that's not the word that you use, but that lives, mm-hmm. these spirits that live under the water, way, way down, and they see everything. And mm-hmm. it's so eerie and so beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, it's more than water and little fish, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Linda, we were kind of texting throughout the week about this book, Lindsay and I back and forth. And one of the first things I was so curious to ask you was, is this a book that you had always planned on writing? You know, you've written so many different types of things in your career, you know, short fiction, a novel, an essay collection. And I was wondering if this book was one that you were kind of building in the back of your head or planning to write at some point, or did it arise more organically for you?
I think organic is a good description of this. I had various things that I had written and was, you know, holding on to and wondering, you know, if a time might be right that they would fit together. And then at some point in recent years, it occurred to me that our relationship with the old stories is something that is so contemporary that we think of the stories, and I mean the stories are they're a way of recounting history and of explaining what is, you know, what is the good way to live, the, you know, mino bimazewin, the, you know, the living of the good life. And and of course the stories are, they are spiritual religious stories, many of them. And so how do those really combine? How do they intersect with how we live life today? And then it occurred to me that we actually, I think, are reliving those stories in our own lives every day, and that it's always been this way. And so when people say, oh, you know, the old stories, they're alive, they are not only alive, but, you know, they are us, you know, and we are the stories.
Yeah, I think it goes along with something I was thinking about as I read, which the mixture of fiction and truth and myth, and even how it's part of the Ojibwe beliefs that even things that don't make sense because that's the way that the creator made them. It mm-hmm. feels very modern in terms of how people approach writing. Cause I feel like even when I was going to grad school, you know, 15, 17 years ago, it was, well, do you write fiction? Do you write memoir or do you write poetry? And now I feel like it's more modern to say, well, it's sort of all of those things, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're all kind of here, which really, this book is, there's poetry in it. There's almost memoir pieces. There's these beautiful weaving of, like you just said, of all of it together. And I wondered if that was sort of, when you were thinking about making this book, like, was that sort of like how you began to structure it, sort of thinking about all of these different pieces sort of coming together to tell the story in the only way that you could when you're talking about the Ojibwe and about your own family history?
You know, I think there's what would we call it? The story of what is happening today, and, you know, the past certainly, and all that's caught up with it as, you know, as history goes on. And I think that the many ways that this can be communicated are not necessarily going to be confined maybe to one form of writing or communication any more than we would a story read out loud or a story read to yourself. It's those are two different ways of interacting with a story, but the soul of the story is there no matter how we read it. And I think that how we might be sharing these things, there are many ways to do it. And I don't know, I guess organic, the word that Alex used is a good one here, how it is meant to be. Ojibwe people have always, you know, there'll be, you know, often somebody will say, well, it's meant to be. it was meant to be. Mm-hmm. And really giving thought to that, you know, what is meant to be? And am I really in, you know, in charge of this whole thing? And I'm not, you know.
Was it hard because these are stories that you've had with you for a long time and that, you know, you said for you and for other Ojibwe people are alive and make up who you are. Was it a different editing process for you for the book? Was it difficult to know where to delineate what was actually going to be within these pages? And do you feel like you got everything in there that you wanted, Linda?
I wrote the way that I think that I pictured someone speaking or me speaking, or, you know, one of my aunts or my dad speaking. And that's how I wrote. And so when I went back to, you know, when I'm rewriting and editing, I do, you know, take a look at that and see, have I stayed true to the telling of the story, to, or, you know, the sharing of the story? Have I stayed true to what someone who'd be speaking would be intending for this to be? Mm-hmm. And so when I was, you know, going through and, you know, editing, rewriting and stuff, that was what was, you know, at the top of my thoughts here.
That's such clear guide. I love that. That seems so direct. I love that.
And what was the second part of your question, Alex? I can't remember.
Just
now.
If it seems like, so it seems like you have such a clear understanding of, you know, okay, I'm going to, if I was telling this story, that would be kind of my guide to keep what's in, if it's true to the way I would tell it. But I guess you answered the second part. I was just asking if it was difficult to know if you got everything you wanted in, because it seems like this, it's such a rich book. And yet I feel like because these are stories that you say, you know, have been with you for a long time that are very resonant in your present life, if it was difficult to know what to leave in, or if you left anything out.
I think everybody who's writing goes back and looks at everything and thinks, well, maybe I would tell it this way this time. And it, you know, it's like with poetry, you know, a poem is never done. It, you know, it's whatever form it is in print at the time. And that could be how it is with what is in Gichigami Hearts. I'm not really sure. I hadn't thought about it. Or are these stories in here taking another form in something else I'm writing, you know, a shadow, that word palimpsest, you know, on top of another story. I'm working on a fiction manuscript right now. And are the pieces in Gichigami Hearts present in that fiction manuscript? And, you know, without me really being aware of it, and I probably, because, you know, the old time stories are, you know, they're supposed to, you know they are certainly, you know, they provide instructions and, you know, entertainment, and they are, you know, they're a guide to a basic spirituality in life that is the way of being Ojibwe. And, you know, I hope that is present in what I write. You know, it's not just me doing this. It's a whole bunch of people and generations and experiences in what is going into what is on the page.
Yeah. And I think one of the lasting effects that it's had on me, is the sense that, that it's not the end, that it's you sort of, providing this history and these stories and these poems and myths and these, truths that you know in your heart, which I love that repetition of that throughout the book. But it's not that it's a starting place and it's not an ending place, but it's something for people to take in and to then, you know, make whatever from it. So it makes sense to me that in your fiction, it's also happening there. It's like you said, a palimpsest. It's happening because this is not, and Gichigami Hearts is not the end of these stories.
Oh, no. And, you know, there are many stories, and, you know, the few that I have, you know, shared in Gichigami Hearts, those are a few. I mean, I don't know all the stories, and that's the beauty of Ojibwe, of that world, is that there are some people who might know one story, some people who know a few, and some who know a lot, but nobody knows all of the stories, and nobody knows exactly where they begin and exactly where they end and exactly the how they proceed. There's not a chapter two, chapter three, chapter four. So they kind of spiral and braid and return to the beginnings. And they're fluid. And yet at the same time, they are so definite.
Mm-hmm. Were there other books, Linda, that you were thinking about or that maybe inspired you to believe that Gichigami Hearts could be possible? Or was it the kind of thing where you thought, I haven't seen a book like this before, I need to make it so? Or are there other books in a similar tradition?
I'm not really sure about that. There's you know, there's a lot of memoir. And there's a lot of different presentations in memoir. I think, you know, one thing that made this book happen was when I wrote about this in the book, when I got an unexpected email from a woman in town, right, not that many years ago. And, you know, I just answered politely and stuff and thought, well, you know, I'll kind of put this to the side until I get a feeling perhaps sometime for how what direction this might go. And so deciding one day that now is the time, and then just putting a little note on my Facebook page. This is a long shot, but somebody contacted
that
me.
That was
a while
so
ago.
Wild that right. That when I couldn't believe that's how you reconnected, and that she, it took her 3 months to see that message, but
well,
it was,
she was
there.
She wasn't, what is it? One night she was up in the middle of the night or something and just went on to Facebook and saw this, because we weren't
wild
Facebook friends or anything.
And, right.
So, and that's how things have always happened. I mean, we have Facebook now, but you know, before that type of communication, this is how things have always happened and how they will continue to happen. And it's one of the things that we don't understand, and you know, maybe we never will, but you know, what we need to do, I guess, what I have found is to watch for them and, you know, accept them for what they are. It's a, you know, miraculous thing, but it happens every day, every minute.
Do you think, because your grandfather is mentioned throughout the book, and mm-hmm. then we get that story with Kate emailing you and telling mm-hmm. you, hey, I've actually met you before, and it was when your grandfather came to your house, and then we get the further story of sort of where he was at that time in his life. Mm-hmm. Do you think that his story, which is the story of your family and the story of the Ojibwe and the story of Duluth, is sort of like the ghost structure of the book, because we do get more information about him toward the end with that reveal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that it is, but he was a very humble person and a very modest person, and I think that he would, you know, he would just feel kind of embarrassed, you know, if he were here and somebody said, so are you the ghost presence in this book? Oh. I don't know what he would say, you oh. know, but I do think that, and I do think that you know, I think it could be that there are people who are born with you know, I mean, we all are born with, you know, with our destinies and our, you know, the things we contribute to the world. And I do think that there are people who are born to do what he did, even with a really, really difficult life. I think that, you know, It was his destiny. It was determined by the Creator long before he was ever born. For Kate, who has, I'm not going to share her name because I didn't in the book, but she has, along with Kate, a beautiful name that actually has a profound meaning in Ojibwe language. But it's not an Ojibwe name. It's from another nationality. And and when I found out her name too, I thought, well, surely this is one of those things that was, you know, meant to be, but that I certainly wasn't expecting. And having that happen just on the cusp of the COVID epidemic.
Yeah.
You know, meeting at a coffee shop where we didn't touch or anything, and sat across a good sized table from each other. And there was such an odd atmosphere in the coffee shop too. People were apprehensive. They didn't know it was coming. They were frightened even. And that might've been, for all I know, that might've been the last time the coffee shop was open, you know, until things cleared up.
Wow.
Man, remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
Really hard.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved the Stone Tomahawk chapter.
Oh, yeah.
Just incredible and beautiful and so moving, and how it ends where it begins. And also its rumination on Native art, which includes tourist art, and how that was lifeblood for your ancestors and your family. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you considered what you do, this book and your writing as a whole, do you consider that art? Do you consider that art that you're making?
Yeah, you know, I think I do. And it's making things. I talk about my cousin Bob in here, mm-hmm. in the book. And, you know, he's been a mentor and a guide to me for many years. And, you know, his saying to me, I was asking him once, I said, how do you know, what is this Indian art? What does it all mean? And he said, well, did an Indian make it?
Yes.
So then it's Indian art, you know. That's how you know. And so whether it is something that, you know, would you call like, there's a very high-end expensive painting and sculpture art, but it's the making of things and the using of your body and your hands, and that involvement, that spiritual and physical interaction with what you're doing, that you're going to make something, and that, you know, the when it is finished, when it's done. I mean, we look at old pieces, you know, like the stone tomahawk in the antique store, and you know, the hands that is passed through, the maker's hands, but then anybody else who has touched it or been in breathed with it over the years, you know, that to me, that is really an essence of art there, no matter what it is.
Linda, I was curious if Duluth is a place that you feel like people stay. I've been a couple times, and it's such a amazing town. And you know, I remember the hills are what stayed with me, just the absolutely shockingly steep hills, and just it seems like it has just an amazing art culture and, you know, a great university there. Is it the kind of place that you feel like people really don't leave because it's so special and kind of tucked away, or has that changed over the years since you've over the course of your life?
You know, a lot depends on the economy here. And there have been times in Duluth where population has, you know, has dropped because of, people just, you know, there just aren't ways to make a living and stuff. And so, you know, and this happens everywhere where times change. And right now Duluth has, it has a lot of the arts, I guess, you know, theater and, you know, physical art and writing. There's a lot going on here these days, but I think Duluth itself, you know, as an entity, it's always there, but so much depends on whether people are going to be able to, you know, to buy food, you know, to be able to afford a place to live. And so, you know, Duluth is, it is a beautiful place, but like the Lake Superior, the place has its own power. And, you know, I use that word formidable before, and I think that's the case with the rocks here and the steepness of the hills and the sacredness of that big ridge of rock, you know, that runs all the way up into Canada. It's, you know, driving here in the wintertime can be terrifying,
right.
You know,
I'm sure.
You know, and so I think a healthy respect for what is here already, what was created, and an understanding that we are just living our lives and our stories against that backdrop. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I was born here. So, you know, I once mentioned that, you know, people love looking at the lake. I mean, I love looking at the lake, but somebody was talking about the lake that morning. And I said, you know, I drive along the ridge here up along the skyline on my way to work. And I said, you know, I have to say that most of the time I don't even see it.
Wow.
And they looked at me just so shocked, like, you don't. But, you know, I thought it is so present and so there, you know, that I, you know, I rarely would I stop to look, because it's just there. And I'm, you know, we are all such teeny little pieces, you know, in the big picture here.
It's almost like it's a part of you now. It's a part, you know, like you can take it for granted the way we take our ears for granted, you know,
yeah, just,
but once they're gone, it's like, hey,
hey, yeah. <a minute.
laughs> I had no idea about, the Gabbro.
Neither did I.
I never knew that. I almost, like, when I was reading about it, I was like, is this a myth? Is this real? And it is, it's real. It's massive and completely wild. And I can't believe that they tried to blow through it twice and it didn't work.
Just, you know, and that's, it just wasn't going to work. And so, you know, what happened is the street, Superior Street, just kind of had to widen out away from the point of rocks. There was no way they were going to eliminate that. I mean, certainly it was, I guess you'd say damaged, you know, because, yeah. you know, big indentations are there, but then there's more of the story too. You know, I wrote about the Italian immigrants who
Piedmont,
moved
yeah.
in, and, you know, they're living in an area there, a blasted out area that mm-hmm. nobody else wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Thought, well, they can go live there. And yeah, and you know, it was funny is a lot of them were stone cutters in Italy. And so they came to a place where there was stone. They actually built the beautiful church there out of that same rock. On the top of, you know, a few blocks up from Superior Street there. And they were stone cutters. So, you know, and I think that's an Ojibwe way. And as you know, we certainly don't have a corner on that, you know, what you have, what you are given, what will you make of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what will you make of it?
And how can you use every single bit of it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do it with a, you know, the respect that it deserves. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's not just ours to play with or anything. You know, it has its own soul, I guess.
Mm-hmm. There are so many funny little moments in the book as well that you just reminded me of. One of them is you're talking to someone who's your cousin because of Carmi, and mm-hmm. you say, "Well, we look like Italians," and he just. He just kind of goes, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. He's a very, very nice guy. And, you know, he was not going to say, no, you don't. But I remember that so well, you know, very, very courteous guy. Just kind of,
That's great. I want to go back to what you were saying about making this book. And I want to know what that looks like for you. What does the making look like? How do you set about writing? Are you writing with a pen and pad? Are you writing on your computer? How do you edit? I want to know all of it.
I write on the computer but I print it out. I mean, not every time I write something, but I print it in hard copy and then read it and make notes and cross things out on that hard copy and then go back and, you know, change it on the computer. So, the computer and word processor, that's quite a, That's quite something. I'm sure just about everybody does that now. It's a miraculous thing. And I enjoy that process that way. Mm-hmm. And I write in chunks of things. And so I have, I used to keep my stuff in a cardboard box. And now it's kind of a mess all over the desk in clipped together pieces. But I used to keep them in a cardboard box and in file folders and think that one day somehow some of these things will fit together. And so that is how I ended up with the first book that the Dance Boots that came out in 2010 mm-hmm. was I saw that there was a call for manuscripts in a writing competition. And I thought, I think I could put some of these together and submit it. So I did. I chose 8 things out of the box and kind of made sure that they fit together and submitted them. And so that is really how I've been writing ever since. And so even though after a while I moved from the cardboard box to one of those milk crates with the sliding file folders. Uh-huh. And that's kind of fun to work with, but I still like the piles of manuscripts, pieces clipped together with good size clips, maybe sometimes in a manila file folder. I like them that way.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a tactile thing. You can see them, mm-hmm. you can touch them.
Mm-hmm. And you can smell it. I'm one of these people who loves the smell of, books, mm-hmm. old books, new books, and so I'm not walking around sniffing the paper, but I do I like the smell of paper and ink. There's something about it to me that I don't know. It's just, I think it kind of gets, well, how could it not get into your bloodstream when you're inhaling that,
Well, of course. And it's sort of like, it's proof of your work, right? Like it's something literally every sense you have, you can take it in with, including the smell. It smells industrious. It smells like things are happening,
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of like it's communicating with me that way.
Mm. I love that. And you say you're writing a fiction manuscript right
yes,
now.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Is yeah. that how you always work? Do you always know, okay, I know this is all going to be fiction. Or is that sort of like you're further down in the process of putting something together now?
Yeah, I think it's a way a process has changed. I've written like 3 fiction books that are about a region, about northeastern Minnesota, and some of the places are real and some are not. So Duluth is in there, and I have a fictional town up on the Iron Range and a fictional reservation. And so this manuscript is my 4th book like that. And, it is new in that I'm really not selecting much of it out of my pile of stuff. A lot of it is just new writing that connects smaller pieces. So that's been an interesting process in that way, but I like it. I kind of like it. And I like revisiting the people in the books at different times of their lives, yes. From when they're maybe, times before they're born until times that they're, that they're elders.
So is this sort of a collection of stories, or is it like a novel and stories, or?
I think it's more of a novel.
Okay.
I mean, it is, it's done except for, the first, form of the manuscript is done and complete, but there are some things that as I go through, I want to do a little write around of some of the things. And so, it's, like everything else I write, and I have kind of an idea of where it might go, but then I, it will go the direction it's going to. And so, what I would call a plot or many plots will change according to, to what's happening today, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I want to show the characters, but also that sense of place and that sense of time and change mm-hmm. over a period of time on a fictional reservation. Mm-hmm. In In our department, American Indian Studies at UMD, we do a great deal with federal policy, with federal Indian policy, and that really has influenced my writing, because someone who's reading it who is familiar with federal policy will go, oh yes, she is referring to this. But they do not, a reader does not necessarily have to have knowledge of this, but I will point it out to them that at this time we are in the boarding school era, or at this time we are during the federal relocation programs for young people. And so I will put that in there. I want people to know that the stories in Indian country happened against that backdrop. Well, as everybody's stories happen against a backdrop of, you know, what's going on in the world outside of their, you know, their immediate home, you know.
Is that sort of, I was really taken by one of the Ojibwe values of an extended view of time and a sense of place in time, space, and destiny. And I felt like as a writer, it's so daunting, but it's also so organic, to use that word again. And it seems like that's sort of what you're working with.
You know, it's so, it really is, you know, the foundation of being Anishinaabe, of being Ojibwe, you know, and that's a, you know, it is a, you know, they talk about lifelong learning, you know, that's kind of a catchphrase, but I, you know, I think that that is how traditionally Ojibwe people have approached life and teaching and learning. It's just, it is always going on. And so we never ever actually learned anything. We've just learned something towards a larger truth, I guess. And so that is, it's part of being Anishinaabe and understanding that we don't really know anything at all. And that certainly keeps you modest, which is a good Anishinaabe person should be.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy when you realize you don't know anything at all.
Oh man, that's me. That's me right there. That's my everyday motto. I have no idea.
It seems like
we don't know what's going on.
Exactly.
It seems like such a like a fun place to start as a writer, to be like, I don't know, you know, but like, I'm going to write it down, you know.
And, you know, the wisest of elders will say something like that about themselves, you know, something very modest. And then they will, you know, proceed to go ahead and tell you something, a truth that is that changes your heart then, you know, and your life takes a great turn, you know.
Wow. Do you have any readers that read your work before you're done with it? Or is it something very personal that you keep to yourself and you decide when it's done before sending it somewhere?
Yeah, I keep it to myself. I talk to my husband about it. And, you know, I mean, he's like listening to this. Oh yeah, you know, oh yeah. But actually he's really a very, he's very good at finding, and not finding, but just from hearing me talk, he will ask a question and I will realize that there is a hole in the plot here.
Wow.
And that is very helpful. And so
he is listening.
Yeah. And you know, that helps a great deal. And then, he will react to characters and that makes, I think that reinforces, their authenticity, their realness as people. He also proofreads things before, you know, the last thing before I submit, he goes through and he finds errors that, you know, I mean, you can't, you know, I mean, money can't buy that kind of relationship. I don't
think. That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's trust right there.
It, you know, it is. And he'll find misspellings or, you know, odd things. And so it's, you know, it's really, really helpful. It's I appreciate him so much in that way.
What a team. I love talking to you because my mom grew up in Mille Lacs, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she has the exact same accent as you do. And it's really just, it's like home. It's so wonderful.
See, and I never hear an accent at all, but once in a while I'll go somewhere and they'll tell me, you must be from Northern Minnesota.
Yep. Yep.
And I think, what accent?
What are you talking about?
But that's my mom too. She's like, stop. I don't have an accent. And we're just like, yes, you do. You know, we loved it. Linda, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. This has been
a blast.
Such a pleasure and an honor.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Miigwech is the word for thank you. And my dad used to tell us that, you know, if there's one Ojibwe word, the one you know, the most important is Miigwech. Thank you. And so that's, you know, I want to say that, you know, Miigwech to you both for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure. Absolutely.
Absolutely wonderful. The book is Gitchigami Hearts by Linda Lagarde Grover. And it's truly wonderful. I encourage everyone to pick it up, read it, and let us know what you think.
That was great.
Yeah. What a great book. I can't wait to read her next book.
Yeah.
I learned a lot.
Absolutely.
Ben and I at one point were going to run, I guess Grandma's Cookies are from Duluth.
Okay.
And they do a half marathon and I think also a full marathon. And we were going to run the half marathon and I'm glad that we didn't because I didn't know Duluth was so hilly.
Oh my God. It is. Wait, have you been there or no?
I've never been there. No.
Oh my God. It is like insanely hilly. I mean, to the point, like, you know, in San Francisco where you're in parts of San Francisco and you're like, what the hell, how does this, it is like, it's like that.
Wow.
One of my close friends is from Northern Minnesota and, from Eveleth. And, we were in a band together in high school, me and some buddies.
What? I didn't know you were in a band.
Oh, I have a good story. I'm about to tell it to you. So we were like playing a few shows around, writing songs, having whatever, you know, like the most fun thing in the world when you're in high school. And
what did you play?
A guitar.
What?
And yeah. But let me get to the story. It's okay, quick. Sorry. It's quick. No, you're good. No, it's like nothing about me is the good part. So my buddy Kyle, his uncle ran a recording studio in Duluth in an old church in Duluth and a huge old church. And it had just been converted to a recording studio. And so like, I guess the most famous band that he had recorded up there was Low, the band Low.
Oh, I love Low.
Yeah. Okay. So he recorded their record, Come On, in this church, Sacred Heart Recording Studio. And if you Google it, it's like, beautiful. So anyway, he said, if you guys drive from Denver to Duluth, I will give you one day free. I'll record it and you guys can find a place to sleep. You know, we slept in like Kyle's cousin's apartment on the floor or something. And then I think, you know, spent a day kind of bumming around Duluth and then we drove back to Denver. And so we recorded like 18 songs that we had written in one day in this church. And then drove back. It was like the best part of, you know, being 17, 18 or whatever, or 16, 17. I'm not sure how old we were, but so Duluth, I always thought like, oh my God, Duluth is this magical place. And then when I was a little bit older, like 18 or 19, I think, I can't remember if it was the summer. I think it was the summer before college or maybe after my first year of college, but I worked at a summer camp up in the Iron Range up near Eveleth. And we would go to Duluth on the weekends sometimes. And it's just like a really special part of the country, I feel like.
Yes.
So yeah, it was so cool to read this book. And I haven't been there in many years, but yeah, it's a neat place. And the book, I think, does such an amazing job of like really positioning Duluth as the unique and kind of haunting place that it is.
Yeah. The part about the water spirits.
Oh my God.
That will stay with me forever. Yeah. There's so many beautiful. And the man who wandered out from the rocks, the Anishinaabe man who ran out, who wandered out from the rocks. And then she relates it later to a man who approached the school and tried to ask questions, but no one spoke his language. And then he just wandered on. It's like, it really is like time is just constantly circling back on itself. Good book.
Good book.
Good book. Good book.
Good book. So you've had a wonderful past couple of weeks. Nothing's gone wrong.
Yeah. My family got the stomach bug, norovirus, good old norovirus at the start of April. Like it took forever to work its way through my family. So it was like someone was always sick for weeks. And then we got COVID, and that also took forever. And now we seem to be getting some kind of cold, some other kind of virus. But at least today in Chicago, the sun was out.
Today was beautiful.
That that made me feel wildly better than anything else.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I can live. I can do this. I can do this. Did you know that we haven't had, or we've only had one day of sun in 45 days?
I didn't know until Britt told me on the way out the door to work this morning. She was like, it's the sun is out. And I just saw, and she gave me that stat. So yeah, it's crazy.
It is fucked. That is so fucked.
It's pretty fucked. Yeah.
I bet Linda would be like, oh, really? 45 days? Try living in Duluth.
Exactly.
But other than that, I've felt like not motivated to do anything.
Well, yeah, you guys have been getting wiped out. You kidding me?
I know. It's crazy how that it just makes you forget what life is like, right. You know, because you just went through it too. Your family was sick.
Yeah, everybody was sick for a while. I feel like we didn't have it quite as bad as you. I feel like you guys are getting like the deluxe order. But yeah, we had we had a stretch like that too, where it was just like, holy Christ, can't get it together.
The good thing is my middle child, Towns, my 6-year-old, has started doing this charming thing where he goes, oh yeah, that makes my snot taste so good. And I'm like, you cannot do this. You have got to stop. And he's like, oh yeah.
Is he also like catching frogs out in the yard and like
oh, he's like my number. Today I was like, Towns, can you go ask daddy to help you wipe your face because you have like stuff on your face. We were having people over, and he just like stuck his finger up his nose like that was going to help the situation. And I was like, no man, like go be. He's just like, he's a very unique individual. He's like the most human person, human in terms of like animal, you know, like we're humans are animals. And he's like at the top of that spectrum.
An amazing dancer.
He's like the most physical child that I have. He is like, I don't know. He's the one who's going to hawk loogies and be like, oh, that's delicious.
I love it.
So that's great. That's something that came out of there. Yeah. I'm going to start reading Erica Krause's book. She's coming on.
Very excited for that one.
Yes.
When we first got, I think, oh God, I'm blank. Lacey
Crawford.
Lacey Crawford.
Shout out. We love you.
I can't remember. She orchestrated that for us, right?
I believe she did. Yeah. She reached out and was like, you have to read this book.
Yes.
And
that's then what it was.
I believe Erica's publicist reached out to us.
Okay. Right.
So that's exciting.
But that was many months ago that it got sent to us. And I read the first maybe 10 pages when it first came, and I was like, holy shit. Like, I know, this is going to be
so
this
excited.
Is going to be unreal.
Yeah, oh, and speaking of, I'm listening to Elon Green's book, Last Call, which is also true crime.
I just saw that won some big award, right?
It won the Edgar for true crime. And it is so fucking good. Oh my God. It's really? Almost like a queer or like an oral history of queer New York in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And the way that he brings the victims to life is truly wonderful. Like at times I was like forgetting that they were victims because I thought I was just listening to this wonderful history of their lives. Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes a true crime book will have a stretch where it's like, it's just like plodding along and it's drudgery.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing of that here. These people's lives are so whole and so beautifully remembered. And I don't know. It's one of the best true crime books I've read in my life, I guess.
Wow. So, that made me think of one of our listeners. I think her name is Eva Dunsky.
Oh, yeah.
Tagged.
Shout out, Eva.
She tagged the show because she had picked up Down City, I think.
Yes.
Because, and I was so excited about that. I feel like that's a book that I hope just continues to have a long, long life because
I love
such a special book.
Eva said it was like uncategorizable.
Totally.
Because it is. It's like true crime, it's memoir, but it's more than both of those things.
That's probably the coolest part about doing the show is just occasionally, you know, one of these books will pop up on one of our feeds and they'll say, oh yeah, I came across this from listening to the show. So that was really, that really meant a lot that.
Yeah. We're hereby taking credit for Rachel Signer, who was on a couple weeks ago for You Had Me at Pet Nat, said suddenly people were tagging her a lot and talking about her book a lot.
We'll take credit for that. That's fine.
Yeah. I told Alex that's us. That absolutely. We did that. but yeah, that's it.
Cool.
Talk to you next time.
Talk to you next time. Bye. See you, bud.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah, yeah.